Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Ah, okay. I'm still Burl Bearer, and I'm still alive. So is Mark C.G. Boyer. We did do a show for a couple of weeks because we were both trying to keep breathing. We were discussing bank robberies and strange career choices. I remember a bank robbery in Walla Walla, an attempted bank robbery in Walla Walla, Washington. Guy pulls up to the drive-thru and pulls a gun on the video camera and says, "Give me your money." And the person goes, "Eh." So they leave, go to the next bank, do the same thing. Put a gun on the video camera. And the person says, "No, screw you."
Okay.
Finally, they get to about the fifth bank. By then, the cops are sitting and waiting for them. And they pull out the gun, point it at the video camera, and the cops arrest them. So anyway, made me think about Jeff McCarthy. Not that Jeff is a bank robber. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Better and better. We had you on the show a few months ago talking about the Great Heist, which is one of my favorite heist stories of a bank robbery, and Al Capone made him give the money back. That cracked me up. But I was just looking over your brilliant career, and you write a lot of books.
Yeah, I'm busy. I do between day jobs and whenever I can, I sit my ass down and do some writing.
Well, you, what's this, was it a futuristic sci-fi thing you're doing? I haven't read those. I know nothing about them. What are they?
Yeah, it's called Relic Worlds, and it's basically, imagine if Indiana Jones was in space. So instead of finding the ancient relics and artifacts of people from Earth throughout our few thousand years, it's aliens from millions of years of being in space on various different planets and within their the ruins of their ancient civilizations. But he hasn't found any of the aliens themselves, so he's trying to use those relics to kind of piece them together to find out what happened to alien life in the universe.
Huh. And he's probably an alien life himself.
Well, we all are kind of, you're an alien to whoever, doesn't know you, so.
Yep.
I guess that's.
It's all relative.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have a bunch.
You have a bunch of alien relatives?
Yes.
That's because they're Orthodox. I'm a sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Get up, bump. Oh, well, that's another topic for a psychologist and a team of psychiatrists to unravel for us.
I mostly just alienate people.
Yeah, well, yeah. You alienate people. That makes you an alien, I guess.
Yep.
Okay, there's a new book out that I have not read that's about Carol Ann Fugit.
Oh, yeah.
That's getting rave reviews. Are you familiar with that one yet?
Yeah. It's called Starkweather. It's by Harry McLean.
How is it?
I haven't read it yet myself. He interviewed me for it.
Okay, people are saying it's good. I figured that if anyone would know, if you'd have to read it first. But I always wonder, when people are doing research to do books on Starkweather, do they contact you? Because you would have more information than anybody.
Yeah, usually they do. In fact, there's a documentary right now called The 12th Victim on Showtime, where I was interviewed, and they had me throughout the whole thing. So, yeah, usually people do. Now, ever since I wrote Pro Bono and released that, people have usually, whenever there's a news story about that that comes out, they come to me. One thing I found funny about the McLean book is on the cover it says, "The Untold Story of Charles Tuckler." It's like, this story has been told so many times that literally the theme of the Showtime documentary was how many times this story has been told over and over. In fact, if you watch the documentary, you see their mirrors in the background. They actually literally use the set with mirrors, and they even have like a prism, so you see the people on the screen several times, because the point that they're making through it is this is a story that has been told over and over and over again, to the point where people don't even realize they're repeating this specific story. So to say it's the untold story is pretty absurd.
Maybe there's something in there that hasn't been told, some aspect of the story.
Well, if he announced it like that, then that'd be one thing. But, I don't think there is. But anyway, Yeah, he, when you read the description, it reads it like, yeah, nobody's really told this story. It's like, yeah, they have. Quite a few of us, in fact, have told this story many times.
Many times.
Yeah. Anyway.
I always wonder about that. If I had a fascinating email from Sandra London, a brilliant author, very controversial, famous. She grew up, her first boyfriend turned out to be a serial killer.
Oh, oh yeah. Right, we're talking about, yeah, Carol, yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, 14 years old, you know, started, in fact, her sister introduced her because her sister had been dating Charlie. And they got together, were dating for a little while, and he was 19, so it was, you know, not exactly the right kind of relationship. And she broke up with him on a Sunday, and that Tuesday he shows up at her house with a gun. He had killed her family, but he didn't tell her that. He took the bodies out and hid them somewhere else. And he basically said, well, you come with me and do what I tell you or I'm going to have your family killed. I have some friends holding them hostage. And so she went around with him, not knowing they were dead the whole time, basically, you know, traveling with him on this whole thing. And then the police basically determined during the whole time that she was his accomplice. And then when she eventually, at the end, when she escaped from Charlie and ran to them, well, they weren't going to let facts change their mind from, you know, saying she was guilty. So they charged her with accessory to these murders, and she got life in prison at the age of 15. But my grandfather remained her lawyer for 18 years, just continuing to work on the case pro bono until he got her released from prison. And that's kind of the story, and that was what I ended up writing my book about.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Now, being as you and I have both done a lot of television interviews for these true crime shows, it's hard to mention I get this incredible email from Sandra London, where she's, and I hope I'm not telling stories out of school here if she's listening, where she's got a deal with a big producer. People want a TV series or whatever based on her life and remembrances. And they're putting together a sizzle reel, and they have her reading this script, and it's got things in there that aren't true.
Oh, yeah.
And she's going, no, this isn't true. They go, just read it.
Wow.
And have you ever read my books? Have you looked at my website? Have you read about me? And they go, no, I don't have to read about you to put together a TV show or whatever. You know, you're familiar with that.
Man.
And
yeah.
She's asking my advice, whether she should stick with this or not. Personally, I would say just get an agreement that says, when we do this damn thing for real, I only tell the truth. And there won't be anything in there that's not true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think they just want to put together a hot reel to sell it, you know, to...
Well, especially when it's her telling her story. It's one thing when it's a movie made about something and they're dramatizing it, and there's a certain amount that needs to be done just to, you know, to shrink it down to a digestible size or whatever. And then that's a whole conversation one can have about the ethics of how much you change, you know, even in a drama.
Inspired by a true story.
Right, exactly. Inspired by or based on or whatever. But when it's the actual person herself, you have, you know, when there's somebody who's actually involved with the story, you have a responsibility to the truth, because now people are really getting the idea, oh, this is the true story because this is coming from someone
who was there,
you know? So yeah, you get that so much here in Hollywood, and it's so disgusting because they don't recognize, not to just keep harping on or directing to somebody else's work, but again, 12th Victim, that's one of the things they really go into, because the Stark Brother Fugate story really inspired a lot of different movies and shows and songs and stuff like that. And it's easy for people just to sit back and go, oh, isn't it cool? Natural born killers, these killers out on the run. Oh, it's based on this true story and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, A, no, it has nothing to do with the true story. And B, people need to recognize there are real people affected by this. I mean, I know a good friend of mine is the granddaughter of two of the victims.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, her life has been, even though she's a granddaughter, her entire life is affected by this. Carol's life has been affected by this. But it's so selfish for people to just be like, well, this is entertaining me, so it's perfectly fine. It's like, dude, there are people affected by this. Everybody needs to start recognizing that when they look at entertainment. Not that everything has to be, like, every movie has to be completely right, or accurate, but at least recognize in every decision you make that somebody's life is, was, and always will be affected by this.
Yeah, but it's gotten to the point now where people will see something on YouTube or Google, and it's complete BS.
Right. You know,
and they'll think it's real.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
I read it. I mean, there was one where Charles Lindbergh and his father are talking about the kidnapping of his child when Lindbergh's father had been dead for 10 years or whatever before that. I mean, you know, I mean, people create all sorts of nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a website that says my brother is responsible for World War III, which hasn't happened yet. Although he says it's possible. That's because my brother was responsible for the USA and China having trade.
Oh, yeah.
And, what are the consequences of that? Well, it's possible. There's also one that says that I am part of an international criminal conspiracy.
Oh,
and because I'm part of the, what are we part of, Mark? Because Mark's Jewish also. And so we're part of the International Jewish Criminal Conspiracy. Where's my check? My check.
Well, you guys have space lasers, right?
Yeah. I even got that shirt. I've got the shirt that says the Secret Jewish Space Laser Corps.
I so hope that shirt was laser printed.
Yeah, it's laser printed on Bush and Marjorie Taylor Greene's forehead.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, in general, people need to really just have responsibility for whenever they put something anywhere, because a lot of times people blame just purely on like YouTube and Google, and like they act like, well, before that everything had an editorial control, which really wasn't true. I mean, I specifically know about that because of the whole Fugate case, because I literally grew up seeing that story portrayed over and over again in completely inaccurate ways. I mean, all these, it was basically, well, whatever is most fantastical, that's what we'll put up there. And I mean, I watched the story was portrayed on History Channel, Discovery, and like all these other places where people really had this notion that, well, because it goes through an editorial process and because it's on a thing called the History Channel and it has all this prestige with it, well, it must be accurate.
Yeah, that's
and,
not.
Yeah, it's so much them. It's like, well, no, whatever is most exciting, whatever we think people will watch, we'll just put, and it's complete nonsense. There are some people who put stuff on YouTube that's more accurate than that, and yet we think that's the best act. So really what it comes down to, I mean, it becomes difficult then to know who to trust. And ultimately what I say is just go with the source, look at what the source is, and, look at their general credibility. Like History Channel has like no credibility anymore. When you look at something on YouTube, look at what has a history of being credible, like, Time Ghost. They do phenomenal, historical types of things. Look at the history of what they've done, and it's like, okay, well, if they have a history of doing things correct, then yeah, you can trust them. But if they have a history of just exploiting things, and it's like, yeah, no, take it with a grain of salt.
I know, it's like, you can find all sorts of it. I like doing this. I do check on the anti-Semitic and anti-Baha'i websites, because I'm both a nice Jewish boy and a nice Baha'i boy of Jewish heritage. And there's one that just hates us both equally and says, don't be fooled. Those Baha'is are just like the damn Jews. They're well-educated. They have high morals. you got to watch out for them. They're too damn smart. Daniel Janus, who was also a nice Jewish boy, wrote the book Sentence, 10 Years and 1,000 Books in Prison. He read 1,000 books in the 10 years he was in prison.
Oh, wow.
And reviews the books and puts them in context of his prison experience, which was brilliant of him, because Simon & Schuster actually owned or has the rights to most of the books he reviewed, and they paid him more money for that one book than I've been paid for the aggregate of all mine.
Wow, man.
And it's a great book, and he's a brilliant writer. He's a great guy. And when he was in prison, he made friends, in quotes, with the neo-Nazi anti-Semites. And
wow.
The guy, of course, said, well, you're not like the rest of them, you know, talking about the Jews. And he says, right. Well, why do you hate the Jews so much? He asked this neo-Nazi.
Uh-huh.
And the guy never thought of it. He goes, well, because they're so stupid.
Yeah. And then what?
That's the last reason I ever heard.
Well, that is usually the reason when people just have a hatred for no good reason. They really don't have a reason when they're confronted with it. They're just like, and they're kind of like deer in headlights. It's just, yeah. They're used to not being questioned.
Yeah.
It goes with my philosophy of the wolf-sheep analogy of people. And there's a lot of sheep and a handful of wolves. Yeah. Most of the sheep have an inbred need to belong to the herd. Mm-hmm. And if they come across an opportunity to belong to something, they come along for the ride. And then they just repeat what is espoused by the wolf in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And that need to belong is what separates people from, living and having a nice day.
Right.
You got sports allegiance, and you got state allegiance, you got country allegiance,
you got
political,
and all that,
religious, ideal,
right.
Everyone needs to have something to belong to. Personally, I'm a Reformed Jewish Druid. I worship burning bushes.
That's not GW.
But yeah, you run into people, you run into the sheep, and they really don't have an articulate understanding of the underlying principles of those that belong in that group.
Yeah, right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, you find that in so many, if we look at these echo chambers, it's like echo chambers exist because, just like you say, people want to belong. I've also expressed it as there's almost like an ego thing because people have kind of hitched their wagon to a certain group of people and a certain belief, and if they find that belief is incorrect, then it attacks their ego, and that's why they end up getting
They get real defensive about it. There was a study done. If you have a paranoid delusion, or if anyone has a paranoid delusion, the brain will do anything to protect it.
So I have a paranoid delusion that Burl Bear is real.
Yeah, but I'm the imaginary Burl Bear. Anyway, this guy's paranoid delusion is that he's dead. And so he insists to his therapist that he's dead. And the therapist says, now tell me, do dead people bleed? And the guy says, well, of course not. Dead people don't bleed. He grabs the guy's finger, pokes it with a pin. He says, now what do you say? He goes, my God, I was wrong. Dead people do bleed.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's a great joke. And that is so accurate. That's one of those jokes that is, like, so funny because it's so freaking true. I mean, again, to go back to the story, I know we're going to talk about the bank robbery, but to talk about the Viewgate story, that is what happens so many times. I mean, in terms of her story, there was never any real evidence against her. It's just there was this sense of they needed the public needed more blood. It's like somebody came to this quiet community, killed 11 people. One guy isn't enough. We need more. The police would be corrupt. So they have to point the finger at this little girl. And it's like, here's one piece of evidence after another. She left clue after clue after clue for the police to find, and the police were incompetent. But the people just did not want to believe that they could be incompetent. They would bend their mind in any way they could to say that she was guilty. Right. And then afterwards, for years, for literally decades, people continued to believe that. Since I had all the evidence from my father, I would literally show them, and they just, and they would do all these mental...
Right. Anything to protect.
Jumping jacks. Yeah. To mental athletics to come around to some way of explaining it. And it's like, well, he still can't be the, and it's like, their explanation was so much more difficult to come to than the basic truth.
Yeah.
I think Sherlock Holmes had a thing about that. He's like, whatever's the most obvious is, you know.
Yeah, the simple truth. Explanation is usually the correct one.
Yeah. And so, you know, but that's the thing. It's crazy because people just, they're just, it's so difficult.
Once their ego and self-identity has committed to a delusion, to a lie,
right.
It is so difficult to back out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost, I mean, look at how many people are still buying the big lie, even after even after Fox had to pay billions to the voting machine company, and after Giuliani has $128 million to these people he defamed.
Yep.
And yet, oh, no, he was telling the truth. Come on.
Right. And the fact they continue to believe that guy and things that he says, and it's so blatantly obvious, and it's including religious people. That's the one that blows my mom's mind, because she's still very, you know, quite religious, and she just, like so many religious people she knows, continue to follow this guy who is so anti everything that Christianity stands for. But it's just like, because they bought into it, because he was a celebrity, now they can't back out of that psychologically, and so they have to constantly do these mental gymnastics to make excuses for him.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been a celebrity at times, but no one's put me on a pedestal like that.
Well, I wouldn't do that only to take pot shots at you.
Yeah, to throw eggs.
Oh, bro, we all put you on a pedestal.
Oh, yeah, so just we can make me an easier target.
Yeah, exactly. So we can look and laugh. Yeah.
Look and laugh. Well, getting back to a Sandra London, I think that what she needs to do is just put in writing, whatever we do on the real show has to be the truth and nothing but the truth.
Yeah.
And that should cover it.
You have to be really careful about it because, yeah, in a lot of places we'll purchase the rights for your story, and it's very tempting when they offer a large amount of money. You have to really ask yourself, what is more important? The truth or this money.
Truth or money.
We had a guest, one of the books Burrell wrote, The Counterfeit Resurrection of Phil Champagne, and everyone taking tally, it was 29 minutes into the show when we mentioned one of Burrell's books. Burrell was working on getting some kind of presentation rights, TV, film, whatever. And they asked you to ask him a question.
That's right. It was actually, the producer was Anthony Spinner, who had just smoked a bunch of pot in his car that soaked into his sweater. He comes back into the office from his car, and he smells like indica. It was an indication he was circling Pluto. So I tell him the basic pitch on the story. He goes, now, would Phil mind if we made his girlfriend's brother a private eye? And da-da-da, I mean, all these cliches, all these stereotropes that are just, oh, my God.
And you would think that he would be like, no, this is my story, but.
Right.
But Phil said, I don't care if they make me a cartoon mouse as long as they write me a check.
Oh, man.
I don't care if they make me a cartoon mouse.
Cartoon mouse. Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, and that makes sense. You know, if there's a certain part where, like, in the case of something like the Fugate story, it needs to be accurate because of, you know, these people whose lives are affected, and it asks a question that is important to our culture in general. But if it's just, like, some part of somebody's life that it's like, you know what, It's not affecting me anymore. Not, you know, it's like, all right, that person wants to take the money and run. Whatever, I get that. But one does need to really question, especially because oftentimes you're selling your lifetime rights in perpetuity. So you will not have your own life rights ever again.
Yeah, Phil Champagne, may he rest in peace, didn't own his life. I did.
Right.
Now, here is a bizarre situation. I can remember what I was just about to say. I just lost my mind live on the radio. I lost
And do us a favor and don't find it.
Don't find it? God. It'll have to come back. Suddenly my mind just went whoop. Gone. God.
That's right. But yeah, I mean, about the, people owning each other. Well, actually, was it about people owning each other's life rights?
What was that?
Owning the rights to their story.
Oh, owning the rights to their story. And whether it is something that they have to lie about. But as we always said about Phil Champagne, if this story is a pack of lies, at least the lies are well packaged. Here's what I was going with this. A book out. It's called something, Burl Bear's Man Overboard, A Companion, right? And it tells you, it's like a cliff notes of the book, and it is crap. It says, Bear's strength in this book is making us understand how he dealt with a wily international criminal such as Phil Champagne. Well, the point of the whole story was that Phil wasn't an international criminal. He just happened to use the same name that organized crime had used for decades. And so when he used the name Harold Stegman, bells ran off in Interpol around the world. Right? And he just happened to pick that name off a grave in Florida someone who died young, you know, like a kid, you know, a little kid. Organized crime worldwide had used that name for decades. Revolution of the Maldives Islands. They had a picture of a guy on a tank in Africa using that name. Senate Minority Leader in New Jersey used that name on a scam. I mean, it was a very famous criminal name, and he was using it. And they thought he was a criminal mastermind. He's just a schmuck from Portland who fell off a boat and decided to stay dead and change his name. But this book says, the international criminal. I go, what the hell? What, did AI write this in the dark?
Yeah. Well, and that brings up an interesting subject regarding AI. Wrote a whole thing, sort of article about this on Facebook about basically, if we don't want to be replaced by AI, then we need to make ourselves less replaceable, because there's so much of the writing that happens that it can be replaced. You know, it's so bad, or it's so, you know, it's so reckless that you wouldn't notice if it gets replaced. And, you know,
I'll tell you this. There's another one that just came out from the same company that has the screwy one about Man Overboard. That's about Burl Bear's murder in the family. And it tells all about this wonderful book I wrote. And it's not my book. It's somebody else's. It's got my book cover on the front. Talking about me being the author. Misspells my name. And the plot and the characters are an entirely different story. Bear does a wonderful job talking about Joe Blow, blah, blah. No, that's not my story.
One of the things that you need to keep in mind about the current state of AI is that it isn't truly artificial intelligence. It does not think for itself.
Right.
What it does, and there's a whole, you know, that's a whole kettle of worms about copyright infringement that we don't need to go down the rabbit hole with. But basically what they've done is they have cataloged as much intellectual property as they can. Yeah. Writings from everybody and their brother.
Including me.
And then they come up with some fancy algorithms and a lot of computing horsepower to index and catalog the concepts that are involved in the writing. And then when you ask it to write something for you, it goes and hunts through all of this information and carves it, you know, kind of puts it all together. And who knows what you'll end up with. Yeah. I don't see true artificial intelligence in the next 20 to 30 years, because developing the software to actually think, learn, and be creative is probably the end all. And unless they come up with the latest enhancements in computing, like quantum computing, where you get thousands of scale and processing power. I don't see that happening in the near future.
Well, they keep putting out these books that are talk about my books totally wrong. They have the plots wrong. They have me praising me for things that I never did.
Did you make any attempt to talk to them? And
why? I just read this the other night about on Amazon. Oh, here's a book, a companion book to. Here's another one. Here's another one. Companion book to Burl Bear's this. And they're all crap. They praise me.
And, they're crap. But, you know, and they're making a couple of dollars a book or something, right?
What's a kind of sad statement of our society, though, is the fact that the human writing is oftentimes so bad that you can't tell the difference between that and AI.
Yes,
you know,
true.
The very fact that, and you know, it's one of those things where, you know, people are, well, we're going to get replaced. And certainly when people are actually putting forth effort, you know, that's scary. But at the same time, just like you were saying, it's actually not as close to actually replacing real writing as people say. But it is close to replacing a lot of these hacks. And in fact, it's really there because the problem is not so much that the AI is so good. It's that the hacks have become so bad.
The other issue is, like, for example, and this is what I was just talking about, where the guy talks about my book, praising it, and why it's all wrong, is it's well written, but the information and the concepts are wrong.
Yeah.
And he's talking about something I do and praises me for it, but he misses the entire point of what the book was about.
I remember, or at least I try to forget, college. And there was an entire course directory for compare, contrast, criticism. You know, the other side of the literary, instead of writing the book, you write all of the stuff that goes with the book. And that was so you could have 3-4 courses that take you through how to do that properly. But I seriously doubt people are running through, you know, the English lit catalog to learn how to do this stuff.
Right. Well, and if they do, they go through so much of formula. And I mean, especially because that's where there have been some people who have written books on the formulas that you're supposed to use for writing screenplays, and that has filtered into the studio system to the point where readers actually have a form they're supposed to fill out that is more like a checkbox of like, did they reach this specific point by this page, and did they reach this point by this page, and what they're really doing is a formula. And typically when you talk to a lot of these writers, they don't know about other things in life that they can bring into their scripts. They've done, they're film buffs. They've just watched movies over and over and over again. So they're taking the history of what they know from watching movies and putting it into a formula of their own. Well, what does AI do? But literally that. And so we're training writers to do exactly what AI does instead of training writers to write above that, to do, you know, something more. So we're bringing down the humans to the level of supposed AI. It was just like you say, it's not really AI, but for lack of a better term, we're bringing the humans writing down to the level of the supposed AI rather than the other way around. And that's why it's confusing to people. Why people are like, wow, is this AI or is this a person? It's not because AI is so good. It's because a lot of the writing, especially in terms of screenplays, has just become so bad.
I'll tell you that when I was more involved with screenplays and stuff, doing adaptations for Warner's and Paramount, everybody's office I go into, I was hearing the same conversation. And that was, have you read such and such screenplay? It was the same screenplay. And they go, yes, isn't it incredible? Everyone was raving about this one particular screenplay that everybody had, and everyone agreed it was the best damn screenplay they ever read in their life, and no one bought it.
Yeah. one of my screenplays got listed as one of the best movies never made.
Yeah.
After Godfather, a studio exec suggest that Coppola go to USC and take a script writing class. Hang on.
Yeah.
So he just, you know, he says, okay. He goes to the class. The teacher gets up the first day and says, okay, we're going to talk about writing screenplays. We're going to start and take apart this particular screenplay, which is one of the best ever written. And it was for The Godfather. So he just got up and left.
That's amazing. I love that story. Yeah, I mean, you look at the formula. I mean, one of the things that just always blew my mind while I was out here, because I was constantly being told, because I went through a whole process for like 18 years and I had in development stuff like that. I was constantly being told, it was never, like, people would read it in the initial first draft and be like, I love it, with a few changes. And of course, there was a million changes. But those changes were always like, by page 5, we have to be doing this. By page 15, we have to be doing this. You know, and it was always plugging in these specific formulas rather than develop the character more and et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that what just kept coming back to my mind, because one of the big things is you have to be continuing, I forget the exact words it was, but basically by like 15 pages in, you had to be, you know, moving on to something. And I looked at the structure of Star Wars, which is the reason why most of the people of my generation, you know, are even doing this. And all these people who were giving me notes of my script, you know, of course, love that movie. I'm like, okay, well, when does the first act?
Hello?
Hello? Uh-oh.
We just lose him?
I believe so.
Oh, yeah, because I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Now we can.
You dropped out for a second.
Okay. Okay, sorry about that. But yeah, to go back to it, so all these people who were telling me, oh, well, you have to end your first act by page, I think it was 20. It was like eight, or it was a very specific number. It was like page 18 or something like that. You have to end it by here. Every one of them was a huge Star Wars fan. And it's like, if you look at that movie, the first act ends 40 minutes, which means 40 pages, into the movie. And so the very movies that they praised, you know, I mean, like, the main character of that movie doesn't even appear on screen until 15 minutes on, but yet, if you were to try to submit to any of these same people who praise that movie, they'd be like, oh, well, you have to introduce your main character within the first 5 pages. So, it's like, they're telling you to, or they're telling people to follow formulas that they themselves didn't even, you know, or that their own favorite movies break.
Right. Can you imagine... If you think about Hitchcock,
yeah,
whose basic tenet for his films was blowing something up gives the audience a very short thrill,
mm-hmm.
but showing the bad guy putting the bomb in place and yeah. giving the good guys 20 minutes gives the audience 20 minutes of a thrill.
Right.
And if you think about Psycho...
Yeah.
The star of the movie doesn't show up for, what, 15 to 20 minutes?
More than that.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
And then the fact that the first person we meet in the movie is the first one that gets killed.
Right. Exactly.
You think she's the star of the movie and she's dead.
And yeah, she's not. One of my favorite Hitchcocks was his penultimate before Family Plot. Was Frenzy.
Frenzy, yeah. What should we call it?
The necktie murderer.
Necktie murderer, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and there's an entire sequence that is almost 20 minutes long where the bad guy loses an earring that could incriminate him. So he has to go and hunt down the potato truck
right.
and the bags of potatoes and find that earring. And there is no dialogue. It is just him frantically searching.
Yeah.
It's just tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I'm glad you bring up Psycho because that is the perfect example. Today, if you were to pitch it somewhere, they'd be like, well, that whole segment of Janet Leigh has to be done in 5 minutes. On 5 pages, you'd have to have gotten it done. There's no way that anybody would let you do that, which, again, is one of the reasons for the down. It's funny because those exact same people who tell you you have to follow these formulas are the same people who will go out and complain about, oh, what's happened to movies lately? I don't, you know, they really question. They don't understand why the quality has gone down. It's like you yourself are the reason, because you're causing, you know, everything has to be a formula. So as a direct result, it's everything's becoming homogenized.
Yeah, it's very peculiar.
And then, you know, how many times have you gone, you know, to Rotten Tomatoes and you get the same complaint, shallow characters?
Right. Yep. The first act gets cut down, and that's when you're introducing the characters, the world building, all the things that people complain about all the time nowadays. They've all gotten cut down because that first act has to, because basically there, I mean, this is one formula that is kind of true of all stories. There is a first act, second act, third act, beginning, middle, end. Beginning is when you need to explain who the characters are, the world they're in, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So you need time to do that, and that's what a lot of the older movies have. But now it's just like, nope, gotta cut to that second act as quickly as possible. And so as a result, you have characters you don't care as much about.
One of a recent film that I believe Burl liked also is Black Phone.
Yes, very much.
Oh.
Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, you know, you might want to check it on one of your streaming platforms. It's a fabulous little
horror film, I guess.
Well, yeah, psychological drama with a little, I guess, ESP thrown in.
Right. Yeah, Red Letter Media talked about it.
Yeah, it's really good. And Joaquin Phoenix is tremendous.
Okay.
As the bad guy. But in any event, how long does it take before the main character gets kidnapped? Is it at least 40 minutes into the movie?
Yeah.
So the world building, what's going on in this town, who the people are, the main character, some of the other children that get kidnapped. It's 40 minutes in before our hero gets taken. And then the play between the bad guy and the kid plays out.
Okay.
So there was one where the first act is a good, say, more than a third of the movie.
Well, it's similar with X. You seen X?
X and its prequel Pearl with the same actress.
Really?
You should check Pearl out.
I really like X. I thought X was excellent.
Yeah, it was fabulous. Pearl is the old woman as a young girl and how she became the homicidal maniac.
Oh,
okay.
So Pearl was really well done too.
That was made after X?
Yes. But it was the same actress.
Same actress, yeah.
That was in X.
Yeah.
And they just made her Pearl. Yeah. So that was kind of cute.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is what's starting to happen with movies now, is you are starting to see some of these smaller independent movies that sort of go under the radar are becoming better and better. I don't know where they're getting financed, because that's what I was, you know, I came out to L.A. to get into that industry and all that sort of thing, and I went to NYU for more of the independent area. But I never could connect with the, you know, the financiers who make those kinds of movies. But that's what needs to happen, is whoever's financing those movies, people need to seek them out, because those are the good movies that are being made. And they're sneaking in more and more, but they're just getting overlooked most of the time. But there are some of these really good jewels out there. The ones you just mentioned, they were all mentioned on this YouTube show called Red Letter Media. And they will talk about some of these smaller movies that come out that most people don't see. But it's like, oh, crap, that's actually, you know, that's the type of movie I don't think gets made anymore. But clearly it did, just from a small company that just somehow had the money to do it.
Well, you take a look at Easy Rider, which still is an incredible film. When they made that and they had the previews, people are saying to Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper, boy, you guys sure screwed up. What a waste, you know? And he and his sister and his folks or whatever, Peter Fonda, went to a screening. They come out, they're all depressed, and he sees a dollar bill laying in the gutter, and he picks it up and says to his sister jokingly, this is the first of the $600 million I'm going to make off this movie.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
And he did. But, you know, when that movie, the very first thing The very first song you hear is Goddamn the Pusher Man, you know, a Steppenwolf. And you see that truck coming, it's like a 27 lens that had never been done before. Never.
Right.
And they didn't even have to, they just asked the band, can we use your song? Yeah, sure, go ahead. I mean, that just totally blew Hollywood's mind. And the movie continues to make a fortune. It still holds up. Of course, Nichols is incredible, and so is Hopper. And
It's that willingness to do something new and different, because people want to see something that's new and something that's a bit different. But any time you try to pitch anything, you can't even get it to the development person, because the readers who are supposed to read it first aren't even allowed to judge it based on its merit. They have to fill out a form that's oftentimes even just a checklist of just, did it follow this formula? Check. Did it follow this formula? Check. Which, again, is literally what AI does. And then they're out there, you know, protesting, saying they want more money, but for writing, you know, or not so much that they want more money, they don't want to be replaced by AI because it's going to do what they're doing. But it's like, well, then stop doing what AI does, you know. And I guess, and it was, I have to be reminded sometimes, it's like, well, it's not the writers, it's the studio, it's making them do it. It's like, okay, but ultimately that's where the issue is you are out there, whether you're being told to do this or you are doing it yourself. You're creating what AI does, and then you're saying, don't replace me with AI, but it's like, but you're doing what it does. Instead, maybe do something original and different, and AI will never, ever be able to
replace. Well, I think it's the independent film producers, the indies, who are taking the risks and doing the low-budget risk-taking and doing some incredible stuff. The studios, I mean, the pandemic thing really hurt the theater industry.
Yeah.
And they spend so much money and lose so much money. I mean, they may make it back worldwide, but people say, oh, well, Marvel's was a bomb because it was the number one movie in America for a week, but it hadn't made back its investment. But worldwide, it probably will. It's like Hudson Hawk. People said what a big, miserable failure Hudson Hawk at $50 million was. Well, actually, it was a big success. It made a fortune in India and Europe.
Yeah.
But you just look at America, didn't do that well.
Well, I was with Bruce Willis, wasn't it?
Bruce Willis.
Yep. I remember him on Letterman. Came on when that film came out. You know, and Letterman goes, let's talk about your movie. And he says, no, it's not. and Letterman says, why? He says, it is the biggest POS. I am so ashamed of this movie. On the other hand, my wife has made a fabulous movie, and that's what you should talk about. It.
What was that?
Ghost.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
He said it is tremendous. Everyone, you need to go out and see this movie. It is really that good. Huh. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't want to know what his agent said to him after that was done, or his publicist said to him after that was done, but maybe I do want to know. But
at least you didn't do Howard the Duck.
Yeah, but that is really big of him to, you know, to stand up and say, hey, you know what, I'm going to take a hit here and say, yeah, I made a mistake. And that's a very refreshing thing out of Hollywood.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for being on the show. Always a pleasure. Buy all of Jeff MacArthur's books.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
All right.
Bye. Hey, Merle.
Yeah.
What's next?
Magic Matt Allen and the Demons of Decadence. Are we decadent enough for him? Outlawradio Live.com.